And welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. This week you have me, Becky Friedman, along with Josh and Justin in the studio as we rub our hands together in anticipation of Snowmageddon 2020.
I say bring it. I can't wait.
Justin, what about you?
I drive a really small car. I have concerns.
So everyone is anticipating the incoming Snowmageddon. And, our local listeners will understand that a forecast of 2 to 4 inches of snow overnight is something that really will put the city and the metro region to a halt. Those of us who may be getting our Ask an Atheist through atheist.radio at our website or where you download your podcasts, maybe listening to 2 to 4 inches? That's so silly. Hi, Minnesotans. Hi, New Englanders. Hello, upstate New York folks. Hello, Great Lakes region people. yes, 2 to 4 inches will completely paralyze our city and region.
Especially since both cities, Tacoma and Seattle, both are cities that are hills.
Oh, yes.
And it's hilariously bad every year.
These things that are called hills, you can go on them with, regular traction, but not when there's any kind of slipperiness or freezy slipperiness whatsoever. And, just be smart and stay home if you can't go out. Or if you must go out, then, make sure that you have prepared yourself with things like, real grit kitty litter in the back for traction. Or use public transit when it's running on, snow routes and things like that. Or, walk to the place or prepare yourself in advance or just see about going without for a few days.
It's not a competition, people.
No. So, Justin, as a native Floridian, as a somewhat native.
Hey.
As someone who spent a good amount of years in Florida, you must have had some of these freezes where suddenly everything is crazy just because there's 2 snowflakes that appear in the air, right?
Yeah. I was born in upstate New York in Albany, but I spent 11 years in Florida before I moved out here to Washington. And you would occasionally get these cold snaps that would end up with a lot of loss of the orange crop and stuff like that. Very, very rarely would you have like ice on the road, sometimes black ice in some places, and people just don't know how to handle themselves. It's not a road condition that you're used to.
Should we all pray about it and make sure that everyone's safe? No, because on Ask an Atheist, we tend to eschew the prayers.
Yeah, I have a feeling that would be less than effective.
So there's another group that we've been talking about for, I want to say a month now, that also eschews prayers. And this is a group down in Brazil. Hopefully it's warm and sunny for you guys down there. In your equatorial region where you're not having big cold snaps and things like that. But this is surrounding the Gay Jesus Netflix special. And I still haven't ended up watching it at all. But apparently very funny, kind of a humorous Monty Python-esque take of on Jesus's supposed story. Where he's about 30, he comes home and it's his birthday and Joseph and Mary are throwing him a surprise party. And Jesus happens to have a little, buddy with him, Orlando, who is very much effete and affectionate in all ways, suggesting that Jesus and Orlando are in this very nice romantic relationship. And, we've been talking about that people across Brazil and even outside of Brazil are really unhappy about this. And to the point of even having firebombed with Molotov cocktails the headquarters to the studio who produced this. This is Porto dos Fundos. We've been talking about, imagine getting so upset that you have to, dangerously try and vandalize the production studio. Just, scroll on, click on something different, let it go, right? Well, there's an update to this because there were folks that actually tried to, through legal means, get this film special banned. And a Rio de Janeiro judge ordered Netflix to yank a satirical film depicting Jesus as gay, only for the nation's Supreme Court to overturn the order on the same day, thereby reaffirming Brazilians' right to free speech. Supreme Court President José Antonio Dias Toffoli ruled that it is not to be assumed that a humorous satire has the magic power to undermine the values of the Christian faith whose existence goes back more than 2,000 years. Judge Diaz's ruling effectively quashes the petition by a Catholic group that had argued that the honor of millions of Catholics was hurt by the airing of The First Temptation of Christ, a humorous Christmas special produced by the sketch comedy group Porta dos Fundos. Brazil's constitution guarantees free expression in the arts, science, and communication. Josh, this is ongoing. What do you make of this?
I actually like this judgment, but I do disagree with the judge's math a little bit.
Do you now?
Yeah, he says over 2,000, but everybody knows that Christianity didn't begin when Jesus was born. I mean, come on, people, get it right.
Okay, if Jesus was in fact a person who was even born, right, for that matter. So if we grant that maybe Jesus was a real person, and if we grant that Jesus lived for 33 years, we'd be looking at what time would Christianity have started?
Probably about 2033, if you're going to use the Gregorian mathematics. But no,
does
also
that take into account leap years?
It probably does not. Right. And then also, AD does not mean after death. I think a lot of people are assuming AD is after death. So like they're assuming like before Christ was BC and then after death.
Okay. And we know that AD is Anno Domini, which is the year of our Lord, right? Or the era of our Lord. I've seen much more widespread use of BCE, before the common era, and
right,
CE, the common era. It still uses the same point in time, but it allows folks to not revolve their entire existence around someone else's God or something like that.
Right. Because the thing is, there's a lot of people that go like, well, obviously Christianity is true because we're using their calendar, not knowing the fact that the Gregorian calendar that we're using right now came out in the 8th century.
And even if we were using our entire calendar based around someone else's faith, that doesn't mean that doesn't follow. That's a huge logical fallacy, right?
Yeah,
there.
No, absolutely. It's I mean, all the way down. But like, there's no point where that's correct, that the timing is actually can be attributed. So his math's off, but that's me being pedantic.
But his ruling is right.
His ruling is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like his ruling. It's good that the Brazilians down there have had their most supreme court reaffirm that they have the freedom of expression to do these kinds of things.
The freedom to make fun of things, including. Yeah. I want to go back to his ruling. It's not to be assumed that humorous satire has the magical power to undermine the values of Christian faith. I don't know if Mr. Honorable José Antonio Diaz Toffoli is of the Christian faith or not, right? This is someone who, regardless of whether he is of Christian faith, of some other faith, or atheistic, I think that if everyone were to acknowledge, hey, you know what, just because somebody makes some humorous sketch comedy special doesn't threaten my faith, doesn't undermine my entirety of values, that's something that's really powerful, and I think that can help to propel folks in a pluralistic society that includes freedom of expression and freedom to worship. Because what's to say that this film that offends millions of Catholics, is made by a bunch of tongue-in-cheek folks? What's to say that something else that is an expression of someone's sincerely held belief won't offend millions of Catholics? And at that point, you're just stepping on other people's rights to worship as they see fit. I mean, all the declaration of faith in one religious tradition is, in many cases, inherently offensive and blasphemous to another religion. And so for the judge to recognize, guys, simmer down, calm your liver. There's nothing in this Christmas special that really is going to undermine 2,000 years of your values.
Yeah, he's saying that Jesus isn't a snowflake and you shouldn't be either.
Ooh, I like that one. I don't know how much snow they have in Rio de Janeiro. But we hope that this will be the end of this drama surrounding this particular Netflix special. Somehow, I think that this will not be the end of it, but hopefully it'll be the end of any violent reaction towards this.
Hopefully, yeah.
Now, guys, you know that you've seen Ask an Atheist on Facebook, and one of the, as you might say, mascots of this show, besides Puffins, Sam's favorite creature, is the prominently featured cat And the cat, Mr. Adventure. He's been talked about on this show before. He is the cat that resides at my and Sam's house. We tend to like cats, but I never thought of cats as like an atheistic thing. Did you guys ever think of cats as primarily something belonging to atheists?
No, not at all.
Had it ever crossed your mind that there are religious affinities or disaffinities and links to pets and certain types of pets?
It wasn't a question that I had thought to ask.
Well, there are some researchers that thought to ask this question, because researchers have found a curious link between religiosity and pet ownership in America, finding that the most conservative evangelical Christians, along with individuals who frequently attend worship services, report having fewer household pets compared to their less observant peers. Additionally, the less frequently one attended religious services, the more likely one was to own a cat. So, if you don't attend services, you're more likely to own a pet in general, but you're even more likely for that pet to be a cat. And especially if you have no particular religious affiliation, you are definitely the most likely to have a cat. The researchers who published their findings in the Journal for Scientific Study of Religion theorized that personality traits that attract people to religious participation might also repel them from cat ownership, and vice versa. They also theorize that the less religious individuals use pet ownership as a partial substitute for human bonding and interaction in the absence of bonding with members of a religious community. Thoughts, gentlemen?
Perhaps this is indicative that humans have a sort of sadomasochistic urge to have something around them that, like, will not pay attention to them, but that they have to dote on and devote their life to. You know, like a cat.
I'm not going to.
Or a god.
Okay. I see where you're going there. All right. So you're saying that I treat my cat as a god, not as a substitute for human companionship.
I'm sure the cat certainly thinks of itself that way.
Okay. All right. Josh, you are both a cat and a dog owner, correct?
Yes. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe religious people have more kids.
Maybe. Well, we definitely know that from demographics. If you are a part of an evangelical sect that is especially part of the Quiverful movement, you are commanded by your own doctrines to have many, many, many children. And there we get the 13 kids and counting, 15 kids and counting. We get those folks that have enormous families. And this isn't just in evangelical Christian families. This is in highly observant Jewish families as well. So yeah, if you got 13 kids, I mean, who the heck has time to,
take care of an animal?
Yeah, so, I mean, scoop the litter box, let the dog out, feed them. So yeah, there could be a correlation between how many children are already in your household and whether you can actually afford, either financially or time-wise, to care for pets and things like that. Sam, in pre-show, kind of in passing, had mentioned, I think the internet has something to do with this. Now, internet, we have all of the world's knowledge massed in our pockets, right? In our back pockets. And what do we use? What do we use that brilliant tool for?
Porn.
I was going to say cat memes and kitty groups. My Facebook feed is primarily just different cat groups. Which ones are chonky? Which ones seem to be employed? Which ones seem to be naughty in various respects?
I'm just here for the memes.
I'm just here for the memes, too. So here's the thing. We know that over nearly 10 years of conducting the show Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, we have heard from so many people who were in very highly religious environments where use of secular knowledge and access to the internet was exceedingly discouraged. So it's not super surprising when I see, if you're really, really super evangelical and you attend worship services like 5 times a week, that you're not going to be exposed to the internet cat meme culture or even Doge culture, right?
Right.
With doggos and fun ways of, making dogs say things. Are you going to really have those Snapchat filters where you get to put little, puppy noses and tongue sticking out on your faces and things like that? Or are you just going to be completely subsumed by your own enormous family and directives to worship your God?
That maybe they treat the younger siblings as the pets.
Oh, there's that too.
That's how it shakes out.
There's some other things. Let's see. The researchers actually said that controlling for all other factors, cats are the preferred pet among those who never go to church. So this isn't just something where it's like, well, we're in the Pacific Northwest, which tends to have a very high rate of pet ownership, or pet companionship, if you prefer to not be tagged as someone owning a pet, but, you know, welcoming a pet into your home. So this is apparently controlling for things like level of education and geography and things like that, where we might see, you know, people in different circumstances and different demographics having different pet ownership. But they say, no, this is when you take all of those factors out of the equation, we still see atheists or the non-religious people most likely to own cats. Mm-hmm. Justin, what's your deal? You're the only one here without cats. Come on.
I'm allergic to cats.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I mean,
that's an excuse. I love cats. It just takes a series of months for me to be around a cat enough to get used to them to the point where I'm not itchy all the time when I'm around them.
Got it.
That and like, I mean, resources, time. Yeah, I mean, I work 6 days a week, so like, who's got the time? I mean, I can't imagine having 13 kids and then also having pets on top of that. That would be insane to me.
Maybe something that there's a difference between cats and dogs. Like, cats may not need as much regular care. Like, you can go away for 2 days and leave cats inside, and no one will have to check on them, presumably, mm-hmm. you know, unless they've got any kind of special needs. A dog, you wouldn't really be able to do that unless you want to come home and do a lot of cleanup, right?
Oh, yeah. You're not going to have a house anymore. You know, it's the whole thing.
There were a few funny headlines, I got to say, when this kind of news came out and people trying to make sense of this. The Daily Mail actually had a headline that says, churchgoers are less likely to own cats than atheists. And to that, I would say, churchgoers, stop trying to own atheists. I mean, really? I mean, yeah. Unless you're trying to be like, oh, I owned you, atheist.
And they fail at that constantly, so stop that. Trying, please.
There was also the inverse of that, and this was the Freethinker, a blogger on Patheos, that says, study finds atheists more likely to own cats than Christians. Well, presumably...
Who wants to own a Christian?
I know. Presumably atheists aren't trying to own Christians. That's immoral. It's just because we're atheists doesn't mean we don't have any morals. Well, if you've got cats that either keep you company and are substitutes for all of your missed companionship since you left church and since you left religion, give us a ring at 844-SKEPTIC. And I don't know, maybe we'll play your voicemail or email us at Ask an Atheist. Other than that, we got some politics to dig into after the break. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, and we are up for some best words, our segment where we dig a little bit into those things called politics. But instead of hearing any of best words from one Donald Trump, we're going to actually hear a little bit about all of the things surrounding Donald Trump that we have yet to have talked basically in any detail during 2019, and that is the impeachment. That's right. We're here with Justin. You've been itching for months now to talk about all of this stuff leading up to the impeachment. Now that the impeachment hearings have happened, at least in the House, I think you're here to kind of help us make a little bit sense of it, because for me, at some point, I had to just say, I can't listen to this all the time. I can't be angered to the point where it interferes with my other daily duties or hosting the show or tending to my cats and things like that. So, Justin, start us out with what really pushed this into the limelight where the House was actually willing to start those hearings to see whether we could do articles of impeachment.
Okay, you are correct. I have been itching, and it's not because of the cats. So the important thing for people to know about this is there was an event that happened back during the summer, and then a whistleblower went to the Inspector General for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the whistleblower complaint was then forwarded on to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice declined to investigate any further. Department of Justice is under the aegis of William Barr, and it wasn't known at the time, but going further, it came out that William Barr has stepped in this up to his gills.
Ooh, interesting.
So what he should have done there was recuse himself from the investigation, and then there would be like another special counsel, independent counsel, special prosecutor, something like that, so that the public has an understanding that there's going to be a degree of separation between the political appointees and the fact-finding mission, so that the public knows at the end of the day what actually happened.
What is the thing that allegedly happened, though? What was this summer event, and what did this whistleblower actually say happened?
So what this was ultimately about is the president abusing his authority as the executive in withholding congressionally apportioned military funding to an ally in Ukraine. And he is doing this allegedly for the express purpose of beginning politically motivated investigations against Joe and Hunter Biden. He is of the understanding, it seems clear, that this announcement of an investigation is going to assist him in his reelection campaign. Now, it's important that everybody knows that it's not the problem that Trump is being tough with Zelensky. That's not really the issue there. Zelensky is the president of Ukraine.
Okay, so it's within a president's power to say, hey, you know, if we're going to give this money to you, sure, as foreign aid, we want you to make sure that it's being put to good use and things like that.
Right. Yeah, like that's totally understandable. The problem is that when he has a question about whether or not this money is going to go towards a good purpose, that question gets put to like the Office of Management and Budget, the State Department, the Department of Defense, so on and so forth, and they came back with an answer. It just wasn't the answer that he wanted to hear, because he's not actually interested in corruption. He's interested in helping his reelection, and because of that, there is knock-on second and third order consequences for the other people that are within the administration who would be the ones actually signing the check or sending the money. And that is among the things that he's trying to hide.
Okay. All right. Josh, is that the way that kind of you were following this? Or were you like me saying, nope, not going to be listening?
No, actually, I pretty much agree with Justin's take on this. Congress appropriated this money specifically, and Trump is trying to use it for his own personal benefit. And that's what it's coming down to. He wanted to withhold it so that way he can get them to not actually commit, convene an investigation, but just to create the the view of an investigation.
An investigation into his political rivals, the Bidens in this case.
Right.
Okay, so it doesn't even matter whether to Trump necessarily, whether Ukraine investigates the Bidens at all. Just having the air of, oh, the Bidens might have done something hinky in Ukraine.
Yes, Trump wants to put a stink on them.
Okay.
It sounds really familiar. I swear something like this might have happened sometime before in the past, but I can't put my finger on it because it was supposedly just a joke that he said over and over again.
Oh, boy. Russia, I mean, if you're listening, this is a pattern of behavior. And what also is a pattern of behavior is Trump's unwillingness to just come right out and say what it is that he's doing. There's nothing that would be stopping him from making these kind of statements and proclamations from the Rose Garden or the South Lawn of the White House. But that's not really the angle that he's pushing. And the angle that he's pushing, the way that he's trying to do this, is he's trying to have a degree of separation between him and where the information is coming from so that it has more quote unquote credibility.
Is this where all the calls and denials where he says no collusion ever happened and, you know, this
no quid pro quo.
Right. No quid pro quo.
This was the no quid pro quo. Okay, so this is what he was trying to say about that.
His previous thing about getting elected was all no collusion, no collusion. This one is no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And so the whistleblower information, that was kind of what was contained within the whistleblower complaint. And there was some back and forth and nonsense about how the whistleblower complaint shouldn't be forwarded to Congress and all that. And then acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, ended up getting hauled in front of Congress to answer questions about this. And the fact that the Department of Justice did not continue the investigation into something that is on its face just stinks of the crimes of extortion and bribery is it put Congress in a position where they didn't have any choice but to investigate this if you're going to get any answers on it whatsoever. So what Congress ended up doing was the highly publicized and public testimonies of Yovanovitch, Bill Taylor, Kurt Volker, Gordon Sondland, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
So that was essentially kind of like an investigation, but happening in public.
Precisely, precisely. Trump would have been better suited if he had told Barr to appoint an independent counsel, because if we remember, one of the more frustrating things for us on the quote-unquote left about the Mueller investigation was how leak-proof they were. This investigation could have culminated in 2 years with a quiet report that got sent back over to Congress, but they didn't do that. Trump didn't want to have anybody questioning him whatsoever, and in his frightened, cornered animal struggling, he blew this thing wide open into the public. And now we have had the testimony of people that are either first, second, or third degree removed from the actual act itself. There are various, between Gordon Sondland and Volker and Marie Yovanovitch, there are various aspects to this, and that is where people are getting lost in the story. But what these people are testifying to is that this operation was a thing that was happening outside of the normal channels.
So with all of these people that are 1, 2, and 3 degrees removed from this, is that where you have folks saying this is a witch hunt, this is a wild goose chase, everything's hearsay?
Precisely.
Okay. But for those of us that are like listening intently to this, does that, which isn't me, because I haven't been listening very intently, does that mean that, what is the drawback to having folks that are those many degrees removed from the actual incident? And then how does it actually help when they are so far removed from it?
The problem with the investigation being this way so far is that you're not getting the direct involved people under oath testifying. That would be people like John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, Mick Mulvaney, Trump himself, Rudy Giuliani, who was the president's personal lawyer conducting the operational aspect of this actually in Ukraine. Now, they had been invited to come testify, and if they had something to say that would exonerate, you would think that the president would want them, just as a common sense, you would think that the president would want them under oath testifying that, like, well, what are you talking about? This was fine. This was like a misunderstanding by those other people, but they're not doing that. The administration is fighting tooth and nail to keep these people from testifying, full stop. So the investigation part of this has, as far as the House has been able to, concluded. They wrapped that up into, and we have a pretty fulsome picture of what happened here. We just don't have the specificity of the first order people who were right there in the room. The investigation is mostly concluded. That got wrapped up with the two articles of impeachment against him, one for abuse of power and one for obstruction of Congress. And then Nancy Pelosi has been holding on to these articles because the House has ultimate authority constitutionally as far as what they do with these articles. just as much as the Senate has full authority to conduct the trial however they want to do. So you have Pelosi and McConnell in these two different wings of the House with ultimate authority. But Pelosi is just holding back those articles for a little bit because more and more information keeps being shaken loose out of the administration because they're trying to cover up a crime. And, you know, not everybody's on the same page with this whole crime thing, because it seems to be that the people who are at the upper echelon don't go to jail, but the ones who help with the cover-up do. So they're trying to avoid that. Recently, we had some emails that were communications between the Office of Management and Budget and Pentagon, a couple of different Freedom of Information Act requests that had gone out. They came back heavily redacted. And I had said at the time, like, just give it a couple of days or weeks, we're going to find out that behind these redactions are statements to the tune of, like, on direct order from the president. And wouldn't you know, that's what some of these communications were.
Now, those communications came out, and it seemed to, this is something that I was paying attention to, it seemed to really coincide with the Soleimani assassination and sort of the leaking of what was behind those redacted emails, saying that, like, hey, the Pentagon and the Office of Budget Management is they're really wanting to release this money to Ukraine back in July, back in the summertime when Trump is being, you know, hard-fisted and saying, no, I want you to do my little thing for me, right? I want you to make sure that things aren't so corrupt. And my thought is, you know, did those things leak right at a certain time that that Soleimani had already been assassinated, or that the decision to take him out had already been made? What was sort of the timing on this? And are our tensions with Iran in Iraq a distraction from the possibility of our president getting impeached and being tried in Senate and being removed from office?
Okay, so the important thing to remember, and if Trump is listening to this, I really hope you pay attention to what I'm about to say. The truth will come out. Like, that is not even up for debate. It's gonna come out. Everybody's gonna know what happened here. As far as the timeline is concerned, with the Freedom of Information Act emails being released and the further communications that are pointing the finger directly at Trump and his immediate circle, for the ones who are literally doing this, saying, hey, get this done, and then being told, like, no, this is illegal, we can't do that, and then they're like, do it anyway. That information starts coming out more and more frequently, some of it through FOIA, some of it through leaks, some of it through just ways that information shakes itself.
Sometimes they send the emails to the Democrats that they don't intend to.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah, some they just mess up and CC somebody who they shouldn't have done that to. But that is what happens when you try to hold on so tightly to a lie. It will fall apart. As that pressure continues to ratchet up, there is very recent reporting that there were some Republican senators that were pressuring Trump. This reporting hasn't fully matured yet, but if there are Republican that they're reporting that there are Republican senators that were pressuring Trump to conduct actions in Ukraine, as sort of a very carefully saying, like, kind of quid pro quo, as far as them being jurors in his impeachment trial, like, take care of this Ukraine thing, or take care of this Iranian guy, and we'll, like, that'll help you in your trial.
Now, you're saying in terms of jurors, that's because if the articles of impeachment are forwarded to the Senate, then all of the senators act as the jurors. Okay.
Yes.
Now, there has been a lot of cries that said this whole process is political, as if that is a bad thing, that this isn't, there's no criminal proceedings that are happening. Well, isn't that the very nature of what an impeachment trial is?
Impeachment is political.
And not political as a, like, oh, it's people trying to backstab each other. It's literally the process happens through the body politic of our Senate, right? As opposed to a criminal trial.
There is a constitutional, they call it a remedy. And the only constitutional remedy for an aberrant or misbehaving executive is the impeachment process.
I like that we categorize or characterize Trump as aberrant or misbehaving. There are so many other rich words that we could use for that, except for maybe rich. But
trying to keep it PG. Yeah,
keep it PG.
And there's also the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel guideline that says that the sitting president cannot be indicted. There's a long history there that goes back to Spiro Agnew. But since that's the most recent relevant OLC opinion, that's the one that stands. So if there is no way to indict a president and hold them to account that way, the only option remaining would be the impeachment process.
So no method to indict, like bring a sitting president through a criminal trial.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So this is the way. Of course it's political because it can't be criminal.
It cannot be. It is specifically in the Constitution that the impeachment is not a criminal proceeding.
So when all of these folks decry that this is a political thing,
they're lying.
We really need to, with our skeptic ears, say, hey, you know what? You're trying to propagandize this as something that is so terrible, but this literally is just factually what happens in
exactly.
this case.
Yeah. Okay. They're lying. They're lying. They're trying to snow you. They're trying to distract you. They're trying to confuse you. They're trying to get you to throw up your hands and say, I can't pay attention to this insanity anymore. And you have to hold them to account.
So next week, it's rumored that Nancy is going to send the articles of impeachment to the Senate. So how do you think that's going to turn out?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is one of the most capable and competent politicians in American history.
So says Justin. Go on, though.
I kind of disagree. But.
You can discuss her ideology, but like strategically, tactically, she's brilliant. The idea was to force the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell into a box where he had to agree to conduct a trial fairly, because that's a thing that we have to force Republicans to do now. And
well, and there's a whole bunch of Republicans that are saying there's no way I'm going to be an impartial juror, correct?
And they also said that they're just going to go straight to vote.
Yep.
Without actually having a trial that calls witnesses and admits evidence.
Correct.
So, okay, so all of this stuff is in the works. How does that even mean that it is a fair trial or an impartial trial or something that isn't a ridiculous circus?
Because they're lying. Like, this is what Republicans do. They want to just have these seemingly strong statements and then come out with them, and then, you know, if you have a problem with it, they're just going to stop listening to you.
So is there any remedy if McConnell says, I'm not going to be an impartial juror, and then they do the hearing, and they go through with it, and they do the whole impeachment trial with some folks on record saying, I am not an impartial juror? Is there any remedy for that?
I'm not specifically familiar with Kentucky state law, but I believe that there is a way to recall an aberrant and misbehaving senator. There is also, I believe it takes it would be four Republican senators that would be required to cross ideological lines and caucus with the Senate Democrats in order to take control of the rules-making process. There is also a way for the Senate Republicans as an ideological body to vote to remove Mitch McConnell as the Senate Majority Leader. So
these
there
all
are
seem like really unlikely kinds of actions that might unfold.
Because they are. The other of the top level of strategic and tactical masterminds in American history is Mitch McConnell. It is wildly surprising that he was so foolish as to say on live national television that the Senate majority in the Republicans was going to be basically in lockstep with the White House's defense on this. I am very suspicious to say that that was a mistake or to say that that was foolish, because I don't think that he is that stupid. I think that there is a tactic there. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but I think that there's a tactic there. Maybe it was the case that he's trying to kind of pre-poison the well of the trial. Maybe this is a straight political angle. Maybe this is a kind of indication that there will be an eventual turning of the Republican caucus in the Senate against President Trump, because he's actually not helping the Republican Party. So we will have to just wait and see. I don't have good evidence or good information either direction on that. However, it's very interesting that he did that. But to Josh's point, if it is in fact the case that Nancy Pelosi will be sending over the articles of impeachment to the Senate next week, we can expect the beginning of the trial. As of now, I haven't seen any information to indicate that the Senate Republicans have agreed pre-trial to have witnesses called. However, it only takes a simple majority of 51, which would again only require 4 Republican senators to vote with Democrats to call individual witnesses. They just don't have guarantees before the trial happens.
Okay. Now, we've been seeing, you know, here and there, you have Susan Collins of Maine and, you know, a few folks here and there that will say, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. I'm wondering, with the number of Republican elected officials that are sort of calling it quits after this, whether that provides them, any of them, with an opportunity to say, yeah, I'll break ranks.
Boy, I certainly hope so. I have this crazy idea in my head, though, where like reality and truth matters to me. So we'll see. And like, put politics beyond that. If it's true, then it's true. And then you can adjust yourself accordingly. But we shall see how that shakes out.
Yeah, I think the math's a little bit worse than that, because you're forgetting Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Doug Jones.
And these are folks that are...
These are Democrats,
but from states that have highly contested elections or very close elections.
So, and they're Sinema definitely not Democrats. They're not liberal or progressive by any measure.
You've got Sinema from Arizona. You've got Manchin from, what, West Virginia?
And then Doug Jones
is Alabama. Mm-hmm.
So like they're.
But wait. We like Doug Jones because he beat out Roy Moore and his horse and his Ten Commandments and his and his mall cop trespasses.
There are different questions to keep in mind here. When it comes to votes to actually remove the president, that would require a 2/3 majority. I find that highly unlikely. However, the votes that would be needed to call witnesses in the trial, like the witnesses that should have been a part of the investigatory phase, the witnesses like John Bolton, Mick Mulvaney, Mike Pompeo, Vice President Pence is apparently in this up to his gills, William Barr, Rudy Giuliani, it only takes a simple majority to call them in as witnesses. And then if you have the 51... then there's nothing that Mitch McConnell can do about that to block that.
When I'm hearing about all of these things in general, I'm thinking, what the heck does it even have to do with being someone who's non-religious? And the link where it comes for me, and I don't know if it's the same for you guys, is the way that you hear Trump and other leaders within the Republican Party being in lockstep with these ideas that are so incredibly dogmatic, that Republicans cannot do wrong, that Republicans are God appointed, that Trump is God appointed, that Trump is a friend of evangelical Christianity, that Trump will do X, Y, and Z to end all of us blaspheming, right? These kinds of things seem to be really intricately linked up with the whole machinations of this particular administration and our most recent, you know, maybe for the last 20 years or so, Congress and Senate, and then even down to local politics. And so it's hard sometimes to see that this has a religious or atheistic angle. And for me, it is not necessarily, you know, Trump himself wanting to establish a theocracy. There are certainly other folks that see Trump as the vehicle to establish a Christian theocracy in America. It is more, you know, further reaching beyond that. It is the dogmatic attachment to authoritarian leaders that when you utter a sentence, it is.
Yeah, the big problem that Republicans have is how popular Donald Trump is with their voters. So if they embrace reality and embrace the truth and turn on him, you can look at what happened to Matt Gaetz recently when he voted with the Democrats with the War Powers resolution to curb the president's ability to act against Iran militarily without congressional approval.
And that was just this week, a non-binding resolution, right?
It was a concurrent resolution.
Okay.
Which is interesting, but I need more information on that to be able to tell you where exactly that's going to go. And what happened to Matt Gaetz is all of the Trump voters immediately turned on him, called him a rhino, called him all kinds of names, called him a traitor, called just immediately cast him out. And Matt Gaetz, if you have been following this at all, Matt Gaetz is not on our side.
Yeah, he's absolutely a Trumpista.
Absolutely. A Trump guy. He has been. He's going to continue to be. You do one thing against the tribe and they will immediately seek to cast you out. So establishment Republicans who've been around, you know how this works. They are aware of what's going on. They just politically, they have built this up. They have excused so much. They have allowed this to go on for so long that if they embrace reality and accept the truth about Trump, they're not going to have a party anymore. And that is separate and apart from Trump himself. If Trump doesn't get reelected, he's probably going to go to prison. Or his family's going to be destitute because he's been a criminal for decades.
Well, lots of things that are, I guess, on the horizon. Thank you so much for putting it into perspective for us, helping us kind of understand a little bit more where this might be going, what it might mean for us, for our country. You've been listening to Ask an Atheist. We're not done yet. We've got some other things that are on the horizon that I think we need to talk about. So stay tuned. We'll get to them after the break. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Still feeling a little bit ominous here in the studio with all the political things that are on the horizon. And one of those has to do with the fact that more than 200 senators and congressional representatives, almost all Republicans, have signed an amicus brief urging the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit and overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 decision that enshrined the right to terminate a pregnancy. The 39 senators and 168 representatives presented the brief at a time when federal courts are being asked to weigh in on a number of state-level laws that severely restrict the procedure. The High Court is planning a March 4th hearing for the case of Louisiana's Unsafe Abortion Act, a law identical to one from Texas that the court struck down in 2016. Two Democratic representatives, Dan Lipinski of Illinois and Colin Peterson of Minnesota, also signed the letter. Most of their party members signed on to their own friend of the court brief urging the protection of abortion access. You know, we talk about this kind of thing because when you say things that are against abortion, it is almost without a doubt based in someone's religious ideology of when life begins and when life does not, you know, have an existence and whose rights are more paramount. You know, a woman who is gestating a life that may come to be, or someone who is, you know, not a person by many laws and a person by apparently other state laws.
This is I have always had this idea that the abortion debate is framed inappropriately. It is not about whether or not the fetus is or isn't a person. Like, that isn't the issue. The issue is whether or not the federal government or state government or local government gets to put restrictions on someone's bodily autonomy. That's the ultimate problem here. So all of these elected representatives are, in filing this amicus brief, are advocating for the state federal government to be able to tell people who have uteruses what they can and cannot do with them. They have even gone so far as Trump recently has appointed a judge that is also against in vitro fertilization. Now, this might be one of those things where it's like, she's a pro-life judge. She's against, you know, IVF as well. And it's like, well, what's the connection to that? It's like, well, there are, if you do in vitro fertilization, then there are millions of quote unquote living human beings that don't get implanted during that process.
These are fertilized egg cells, right? Yeah. Okay. So these are little just itty bitty embryos that, haven't been implanted yet.
And if they overturn Roe v. Wade, the ideological inconsistencies will be hashed out. They will be going for in vitro fertilization next. Like, this is just a process where it is more and more restriction on a person's bodily autonomy.
Well, in that, we look at the state level where we see Nebraska's Governor Pete Ricketts, who has declared 2020's Roe v. Wade anniversary to be statewide day of prayer to end abortion. He's encouraging all Nebraskans to pray on their own or with others according to their faith for an end to abortion. The proclamation also urges Nebraskans to take direct action to aid mothers, fathers, and families in need. A gubernatorial press release stated that, according to Nebraska state law, it is the will of the people of the state of Nebraska and the members of the legislature to provide protection for the life of the unborn child whenever possible. So, Josh, you're laughing here a little bit. You're chuckling, right? What was the funny part there to you?
Oh, the governor's name is Ricketts.
Okay, all right.
I wouldn't certainly wish that on him at all.
So, no, certainly not. What I don't wish either is for anyone to be told by their elected official that you need to pray, right? And the fact that he says pray on your own or with others and according to your faith. Well, there are faiths where according to the religious doctrine or the consensus of that religious community, it is more moral to terminate a pregnancy in certain cases than it is to fully gestate a pregnancy. So, Governor, first of all, you're telling everyone that they need to pray. What about all those non-religious individuals within your state? Do you just, you know, you want to force us to pray, or do you just want to, like, I don't know, not even acknowledge our existence? And two, you don't even realize that there are people who have sincerely held religious beliefs who actually believe in a God that do believe it is more moral for abortion procedures to occur.
And I mean, so he also says to pray, but also is saying take direct action.
This is the scary part.
That's kind of scary. I mean, like he says, take direct action to aid mothers, fathers, and families in need. That can be taken in so many ways. It could be their pregnancy crisis centers, or it could be more direct, explosive action that seems to be in vogue.
Yeah, anti-abortion activists aren't exactly known for being stable.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised.
If prayer worked, you wouldn't have to take direct action.
Right.
And now when you say, like, let's have direct action to actually help families, that's a good thing. When you say, if you're going to outlaw abortion, let's actually provide for families. But he's not saying we as a state are going to fund affordable daycare or make daycare and childcare free. He's not saying as a state of Nebraska, we're going to provide anyone who has an unintended and asked for pregnancy to be able to have $20,000 a year extra to raise your child yearly. He's saying, oh, you wonderful people of Nebraska, why don't you guys do it yourself? Because I, as a representative of the state, want this to happen.
I believe it was Montana, under the governorship of Steve Bullock, if I'm remembering correctly, that they had a teen pregnancy crisis or scare or increase, something like that. So they pushed forward legislation to provide low cost or free IUDs.
Ah, this is the state of Colorado.
Was it Colorado?
Yeah, Colorado.
Okay, not Montana.
for young women that were even teens, without needing parental permission, you could get a long-acting contraceptive, which is an IUD.
Right.
And the rate of teen pregnancy fell.
The rate of abortion plummeted.
Yeah, imagine that kind of direct action. Even that little bit. But the problem here is that you have people that have these religious convictions that says that even if you have a long-acting contraceptive that's an IUD, it's an abortive fashion, which is literally incorrect factually. Yeah. But courts have said that, well, because they believe that religiously, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's where courts are holding up someone's religious belief in direct contradiction to medicine and reality and science, that it says, oh, we're just going to nod our heads at that because, you know, freedom of religion.
Yeah, they are actively ignoring, again, facts and reality. Where have we seen that before? And they are, it is not, they are saying this as if they are saying this out of a place of compassion and love and care and concern. It is not about that.
No, it's about control.
It is about control. Do not let them tell you otherwise.
A good thing to be on the lookout now is that since we're in the very beginning of the calendar year, so many of your state and local legislatures have gone back into session. And there may be these kinds of proclamations. There may be these kinds of laws that are trying to get in to restrict access to long-acting birth control, contraception. There are things that have nothing to do with anyone's reproductive rights, but have everything to do with control. Things that have to do with curriculum that is allowed in public schools, with what kind of religious beliefs are valid enough to allow a child to remain unvaccinated, endangering him or herself and others all around him. And it's a really good idea and point to be on the lookout to all of those bills that are being floated in your local areas, at your local levels, and at your state levels, too. You know, Justin, Josh, thank you guys so much for joining today on Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Justin, thanks for clarifying a few of those mystery things that have been going on for 6 months. You have been listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Our music is by Chris Cullman and Phil Whitfield. You can find us at atheist.radio. Email us at questions@atheist.radio. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ask an Atheist WA. We'll see you guys next week.